Turn up your volume. Because you're about to listen to The Sick Podcast. With Tony Marinara.
55 seconds left in the penalty, a minute and 27 seconds left in regulation time. Boston 4, Montreal 3. Lafleur coming out rather gingerly on the right side. He gives it into Lemaire, back to Lafleur. Oh!
The Sickest Montreal Canadiens Podcast. Sports entertainment like no other.
Rejoins, on lui fait perdre la rondelle, une passe devant. Et c'est la bonne fois, ce sera la victoire des Canadiens. Stanley pour les Canadiens, le 23e de l'histoire.
You found the dogs! John, you found the dogs! He found the dogs!
And all together, they worked a young team to the top. And now, a 24th Stanley Cup banner will hang from the rafters of the famous Forum in Montreal. The Canadiens win the Stanley Cup!
Brought to you by Energy Transportation Group. Driven to be different. La Vida TV. Embrace your true nature. And Playground, your premier gaming destination. It's gonna be sick.
Marinaro on this Tuesday, January 16. How is everyone doing tonight? It is the Sick Podcast, and of course, it's brought to you in part by Energy Transportation Group, a leading full-service logistics provider serving all of North America, driven to be different. Also brought to you by these guys right over here, La Bita TB, brewed in Quebec. A winner of a dozen international awards, La Bita TB offers quality microbrewery beers made with premium ingredients for everyone's taste. La Bita TB, embrace your true nature. Also brought to you in part by Playground. Discover a world of luxury at Playground. Explore their new 30,000 square foot expansion with thrilling games, gourmet dining, and live entertainment located just over the Mercier Bridge, only minutes from downtown Montreal Playground. Playground, experience the strip without the trip. All right. Okay. So it was yesterday when Montreal Canadiens general manager Kent Hughes met with members of the media, of course, which is a tradition of sorts because the general manager always meets with members of the media at the midway point of the season to discuss, you know, the first half of the season, to talk about individual performances, what's up with his team, what he sees. And of course, he's asked all the questions. Tonight is a special show because I think it's one of the most important parts of the season. The general manager of the Montreal Canadiens doesn't speak every day. He'll speak the day of the golf tournament. He'll speak at one point during training camp. He'll speak at one point, maybe a quarter of the season in, halfway point, three quarters of the season in, probably a day before trade deadline or the week of trade deadline, the day of trade deadline day. And then, of course, at the end of the season. And then again at the draft. Probably talks about, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 times a year. So when the general manager does talk, it's important because there's some things that we probably already knew, but there's some things that we learned. So tonight's a special show for me because I wanted to bring in someone who's worked in the National Hockey League at every level, whether it was a head coach, whether it was an assistant coach, whether it was an assistant GM, whether it was in player development, whether it was in scouting. And I found my guy. So we got a real hot guest, and I'm going to do this for Agnello and Sammy and Master Control. I'm going to light the studio on fire, almost, anyway. Not really. Okay, there we go. I almost blew up the machines there. Let's bring him in. None other than Pierre Maguire.
Oh, Tony, you too, man. That was good.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. That was very nice of you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And, of course, for those who don't know by now, if you've been hiding under a rock or living under a rock, but Pierre is, of course, a co-host on the Sick Media Network, the Sick Podcast Eye Test, along with Jimmy Murphy. They've had some truly amazing guests so far. Scotty Bowman was one. Kent Hughes was another, and a long list of others. And I know earlier today they actually talked about a possible trade scenario for the Canadiens because a lot of members of the Montreal Canadiens fan base are clamoring for one very young, talented player who plays in Anaheim. We're going to get to that a little bit later, and we're going to get Pierre's thoughts on that. But Pierre, you know what? Let's jump right into it. Kent Hughes yesterday meets with members of the media, and the first question he's asked is about his two young guns, his two most important players, or two of his three most important players, depending on which way you look at it, maybe even two of four. But the most popular ones, Suzuki and Caulfield. This is what he had to say about Nick Suzuki.
Prenons la foi. Je pense que on voit une progression de Nick dans son jeu complet. Probablement plus défensivement. Je sais que les points sont encore là offensivement aussi, mais on voit que il continue à devenir un joueur de 200 pieds de la glace. Alors, on est très content de sa progression.
All right, there you have it. Kent Hughes, who says, all right, let's start with Nick Suzuki. I'm seeing a progression in terms of his 200-foot play, so I'm very happy in that regard. Pierre, I've seen some stats over the last couple of weeks. Here in Montreal, there still is an ongoing debate for some whether Nick Suzuki is elite or isn't, because, of course, he's still young in his career. He hasn't hit the point per game mark yet, and a lot of people view elite as hitting the point per game mark. But there's some categories where he's pretty elite. Sports Logic came out with some stats a couple of weeks ago. In terms of forwards in the National Hockey League who maintain the puck in the offensive zone longer than the rest, I believe Nick Suzuki ranks 13th in the National Hockey League. Based on other stats that were put out there by Dominic Lecision of The Athletic, who had certain criteria, you have to play at least 16 minutes per game. You have to play versus top two-line players. You have to play a minimum of 15% of your team's penalty kill. He actually had Nick, so he made a case that Nick Suzuki could be first right now in the running for the Frank Selke Trophy. Yeah. Saw the assist last night to Slafkovský. I saw the assist the other night to Caulfield. Pierre, there's a lot of facets of Suzuki's game that are elite.
Absolutely. excuse me. He's just starting to find his way, honestly. And what people need to remember, there are two key players of the Montreal Canadiens that aren't there right now, Alex Newhook and Kirby Dach. And because those two players aren't there, the matchups, especially against a team like Montreal that's a little bit offensively challenged, after you take away Caulfield and you take away Slafkovský and you take away Suzuki, other teams game plan to stop three players. They don't game plan, Tony, to stop, you know, six. They game plan to stop three. So anything you're getting from Nick offensively is a huge bonus, number one. And I agree with you, by the way. Elite players in this league are point-of-game players and point-of-game or plus or more. Nick's getting close to being that. But what I agree with Kent Hughes on is he is clearly evolving as a great two-way centerman. And, you know, Patrice Bergeron was a great – and I'm not saying Nick Suzuki's Patrice Bergeron, but Patrice Bergeron took some time too. People forget. You know, everybody remembers the Bruins from 2011 going forward. They don't remember, you know, from 2005 to 2010, the Bruins were like this, and Patrice was part of that. So there's an evolving period for a young player like that. But I think Nick is doing great. And everything I think that Ken Hughes said about him is spot on.
Pierre, if you were the general manager of the Montreal Canadiens, you take a look at your young talent. Do you think there's enough young talent there at the forward position to be a Stanley Cup contender at 1.5, 6, 7, 8 years down the line? Or would they need to finish top five again to be able to secure another talent?
They need another top-end scoring talent. There's no question. I think Slafkovský is going to be that guy. I think Cole Caulfield is going to be that guy. We still don't know yet on Kirby Dach. We'll see how it goes. I don't know if Newhook's going to be better as a number nine forward or in the 9 to 10 range, or if he's going to be a top six. Nobody really knows what his exact situation is going to be. So I definitely think they need another scoring forward. I would cede you that. But I think they're well on their way. And the one thing I'd say about the Canadiens right now that people are way underplaying is their depth on defense. And I think, you know, Tony, to be fair, Rome wasn't built in a day, but I think that they've done really good steps in terms of building their defense. And I think eventually it's going to pay huge dividends. I really do.
Is that going to be the way to go out and get that forward if it's not via the draft?
Yeah, I think that's why I brought it up. They're going to have enough depth. So right now, just Laval's become relevant again in the American Hockey League, and I'm sure you're following it. They were not relevant the first 15 to 20 games of the season in the AHL. They are relevant now, which is really good news. And part of that is because Arbor Jacki and Logan Mailloux are playing fantastically well together as a tandem. And you see the evolving play of Jaden Struble. You see Jordan Harris. You see Caden Gooley. You see Mike Matheson. I know there's some rumors out there they're going to trade Mike. I don't believe that, but I don't know that. I'm just telling you, I don't believe it. But you start to see the defense. Justin Barron is another one that comes to mind. Tony, a lot of teams in the league would love to have that age and defensive depth that the Canadiens are starting to build. It's pretty exciting.
I'll go there now because you brought up his name. But, Pierre, you know, Kent Hughes has talked about Montreal being good for some players in terms of their development, Laval being better for others. Uh-huh. The Canadiens took the decision to keep Juraj Slafkovský with the big team when a lot of people thought maybe Laval would have been better for him. Right now, it looks like the Canadiens made the right choice, and I get it. Juraj Slafkovský is a first pick overall, and there's going to be a different kind of mindset in terms of the way you're going to treat him or develop him compared to an Arbor Jacki who was never drafted. But the decision to send Jacki to Laval after he had a good season last year and caught a lot of people by surprise, can you explain to those watching and those listening why it was better for Jacki to go to Laval and not continue his development in Montreal the way some others have?
Because his development would have stopped in Montreal because of the pace of the game and because they would have counted on him to do one thing, and that would be to be the sheriff, to be the policeman, to be the bodyguard for the team. And he can be more than that. And I think one of the reasons why they were right to send him to the American Hockey League was to develop his puck skills, to develop his skating skills, to develop his awareness when it comes to defending the lead or having to get the lead back. And I think he's doing all those things right now in Laval. I follow it really close in the American Hockey League. And it's exciting. I think the Canadiens did the right thing. And this is not a knock on Major Junior Hockey, but Jaden Struble was coming out of major Division I college hockey where he's playing against 23- and 24-year-old men. Arbor Jacki was coming out of junior hockey where he's playing against 20-year-old guys. It's a monumental difference. And I watch both a lot, junior and college, and it is a gigantic difference. So Struble was more prepared to take that next leap, and you can see it right now. It's kind of like, I'll give you an example, Tony, just for the veteran fans of your great show. When Chris Chelios came out of the University of Wisconsin, people were like, why isn't he going to the American Hockey League? And the Canadiens are like, wait till you see the guy play. And then you see the guy play as a Hall of Fame career. So it's just, some guys just need a little bit longer, especially when they're playing against younger players coming in. You talk about Slafkovský. I spent a ton of time in Finland. I saw Marty Lapointe there a lot, the Canadiens' chief amateur scout, in Turku, which is a drive from Helsinki to the west. And I can tell you right now, when you watch Slafkovský play, he was a third-line player playing against men in Turku, and he never got big minutes at key times and games because his coach was obstinate, didn't believe that young players should play. So now you get him over here and you put him in against men. He's physically able to do it. And all of a sudden, you're starting to say, this guy's really good. So every guy's different, Tony. It's not one size fits all. Every guy's different. And I think the Canadiens did the right thing with Arbor Jacki. I think it'll pay long-term dividends.
I don't think when the Canadiens sent Jacki to Laval, it was, we're going to pair him with Logan Mailloux, and maybe one day they're going to end up being a pairing together in Montreal. They sent Jacki there so he can further his development. But since he's been there, there's been an incredible chemistry that has transpired with Mailloux. They're both feeding off each other, and they're both helping each other out with their game. If you're a member of the Canadiens management team, now are you looking at them saying, I think these guys can take this and have it translate to the National Hockey League in a year or two down the line and end up being a pairing in the National? Can you see that?
Absolutely. And that's why I brought it up when I started, when you asked me the question. You know, the truth is that, yeah, you can find that development and you can bring players up and they can play unbelievably well together. And I think that's something you're going to see long term. The Canadiens, by the way, it's before your time and maybe before mine, but they used to spend, guys never made it to the Montreal Canadiens unless they went to Halifax and play for the Montreal Voyageurs. Larry Robinson went there. Doug Riseborough went there. I mean, lots of guys went there, and they learned how to play. Lou Lamoriello, there are only two players that I could think of with the New Jersey Devils over his time running the Devils that ever made it straight into the National Hockey League after they were drafted. One was Scotty Niedermeyer in the Hockey Hall of Fame, and the other one, Scott Gomez. Marty Brodeur went to Utica. He played in the American Hockey League. Billy Guerin was a fifth overall pick. He played in the American Hockey League. Going down in the American League is not a punishment. I think it's actually a benefit for a lot of players. I really do.
For a long time, the Detroit Red Wings down with Grand Rapids almost had like a rule of thumb that their players had to spend a good 3 years in the American Hockey League or about 250 games before being recalled. And then once they did, they had basically a program where they had veteran players mentor some of those young players coming in, right?
100%. And they used to call it a simple formula, overripe compared to underdeveloped. And they did that with a lot of players, 100% correct.
Because of all the defensemen the Canadians have, Matheson and Savard, but you know, we would think that at one day they'll probably be moved out. Let's just say Savard might end up being moved out next year. He'll be in the final year of his contract. Mm-hmm. Mike Matheson maybe a year after that, but then you'll have Lane Hutson that's going to be on his way at the end of the year, and you'll have Logan Mailloux at one point. You have Arber Jacka, you have Jordan Harris, you have Jaden Struble, you have Caden Gooley. There's Kovacevic there right now, Justin Barron. David Reinbacher, the list goes on and on. Because of so many defensemen, and Kent Hughes calls it a good problem, Can you at all see, and I know you've seen examples of this before, so it's probably not the craziest idea in the world, can you see Arber Jacka being converted to a winger?
Yeah, the Canadians did it with Rick Chartier way back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
I could see. I mean, yeah. Do I think it's something they're going to do? No. Not right away, because I think they see the value in having the size on defense. So one of the ways teams really try to manufacture offense in today's NHL, and you hear the analysts say it all the time, taking the goalie's eyes away. Well, you need guys that can clear the crease. And smaller guys, especially Elaine Hudson, I'll use him as an example. He's not going to be able to do that, Tony. Bigger people will be able to do that. It's not going to be easy for Caden Gooley, who's a really strong kid, to clear the crease. But a player like Arber Jacka or a player like Logan Mailloux, those guys can clear the crease. And there's something to that I don't think can be quantified with stats. It's not an analytic equation that can formulate a guy that can clear the crease. And so I see him having more value as a defenseman and more value as being a defenseman that is not just counted on to be a thug, is counted on to be a crease clearer, a penalty killer, a guy that can defend the lead late in the game. And if you need to stabilize things physically, he can do that too.
So I guess for Lane Hudson, when he ends up making the jump to the National Hockey League, the plan is either going to be to have a right-handed defenseman who can clear that crease or to have a player complement them. And the strategy is going to be to try and hold possession of the puck as much as possible, so they won't have to clear the crease.
Well, yes. And so I see Lane play a lot, and I saw him play last week. He had a little bit of a World Junior hangover, obviously winning a gold medal. But the creative brilliance of his offensive game is stunning. It really is. So I haven't seen a lot of players that I could say, oh, yeah, he reminds me of him. Lane Hudson reminds me of Adam Fox. When Adam Fox was at Harvard, I used to go watch them practice all the time. I used to go watch them play a ton. My son still plays against Harvard a ton. And so I know Adam Fox's game unbelievably well. And the similarity is Adam Fox to Lane Hudson. You know, obviously one plays on the left side, one plays on the right side. But I would just tell you, offensively, their ability to process the game is amazingly similar.
Pierre, Kent Hughes yesterday was asked about the fact that the Canadians haven't had a point per game player in a long this time. The last time they did, I believe, was Alex Kovalev. He had one season of 84 points under Guy Carboneau, and probably before that, and I could be wrong by saying this, but it was probably Turgeon, Danfous back then.
I would say Turgeon.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then Kent Hughes said Patrice Bergeron never had 82 points either. And then members of the media said, yeah, but some of his line mates did. And Kent Hughes said, yeah, but part of that was probably a big reason why it was probably Patrice Bergeron. If the Canadians don't have a player going forward that's going to produce 90 points, 95 points, 100 points. And they have to rely on a committee. Your school of thought on having players who put up a ton of points compared to teams that try and do it by committee. Is there one strategy that you like more than the other, and can both win?
I think it's really hard in this NHL to win with just the offensive players. Edmonton and Toronto are Exhibit A and Exhibit B. You can't outscore your problems in the playoffs. We'll see if it works this year. It hasn't worked to date. Vegas is a great example of how you can defend and do things by committee, and that's how they do it in Vegas. I mean, I know Jack Eichel is there now, but a lot of people don't realize that Chandler Stephenson is a huge driving force for that team, and he's not a point-of-game player. You know, Jonathan Marchessault is a really good player, but he's not a point-of-game player, and he was an undrafted player coming out of junior. So, you know, you look at the Vegas model and you say, that model works. You look at the Tampa model and everybody says, oh, you know, Kucherov, Stamkos, Braden Point. What they don't tell you is Barkley Goodrow, Yanni Gord, Blake Coleman, Alex Killorn. They don't talk about, you know, Pierre-Edward Belmar. They don't talk about the size and defense with Chernak, with McDonough, with Sergachev, with Hedman. You know, the Tampa model, the Vegas model, that's the model that I think is better. And, you know, you see it in Tampa. They did it by committee, even though they had the superstars. And you see Vegas, it's the same thing, the big bodies in defense. St. Louis is another example. They did it by committee. It's way more reliable. It's way more reliable.
Especially since if you're banking on the offensive star like the McDavid or the Matthews, especially the McDavid, if he gets hurt, you're in trouble.
You're so smart, my friend. So, Tony, I was talking to my partner on our podcast today, and I did this thing for him, and he's like, never thought of it that way. So if you look at the goal differential in the Atlantic Division, just the top three teams, Boston's number one, they're plus 30. Florida's number two, they're plus 25. Toronto's number three, I think they're plus 14. Again, just going off the top of my head. So think about this. If you were to take five goals away from Austin Matthews, who's got 33, and five goals away from Nylander, who's got, I think, 22 or 23, and then you took five goals away, let's say, from Mitchell Marner, do you know where that would put the Toronto Maple Leafs, goal differential-wise? Out of the playoffs. Out of the playoffs. So to your point, if you lose one player on the all-offense type situation, like let's just say Austin Matthews, you take his 33 goals out, where do you think they are? They might be a lottery team because they don't have the defense and they don't have the goaltending. So it's a really dangerous game if you're not doing it by committee and you haven't built up the assets on defense and a goal.
It's funny you're saying this because I was taking a look at some stats from Toronto a couple of days ago. Their play without the puck does not reflect very well in terms of stats. It's really porous. And, you know, they need a defensive structure. I mean, I'm no coach by any means, and that's above my pay grade. I'm not qualified for that. But correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know if Sheldon Keefe has been able to put in that defensive structure or been able to sell his players on the idea that they're going to need to play a two-way game if they're going to want to win.
They got a really smart coaching staff there. Guy Boucher is not a dumb guy. He's a smart coach. He's on the bench there. Dean Chenault is a really good hockey coach, I'm telling you. He runs their defense. They've got some good people there. I think they've worked hard. I love what you just said. I think they've worked hard to implement a defensive strategy. I don't think they have the assets, the horsepower to get that done with the schematic they're trying to implement. So it's hard. They've spent their collateral on trying to get forwards. It's really apparent. They don't have enough depth on defense. And even their farm team, if you look at their farm team in Toronto, and I watched them play a ton, they've got a huge payroll. They don't have a lot of defense coming along. They got a lot of good forwards, you know, smaller skilled guys. They don't have a lot of defensemen on the come.
Back to the Canadians. Let's do that. Asked about Cole Caulfield's lack of goal production.
Sure, like, could,
je dirais pas, j'utiliserais pas les mots décevant ou inquiétant, mais c'est sûr que tu veux toujours que tes scoreurs scorent. Mais on sait aussi, à part des gardiens, la chose la plus difficile à faire d'une manière constante d'une année à l'autre et entre une année, c'est de scorer. À part de Ovechkin, on ne voit pas tout le temps. Qu'est-ce que je voudrais pas, c'est que Cole joue différent ou sans la pression parce qu'il paye plus. On veut que Cole soit Cole. Cole amène tellement à l'équipe. Qu'est-ce que je suis vraiment impressionné de lui, c'est qu'il est encore le gars souriant dans la chambre parce qu'il est vraiment important dans la chambre. Il amène un certain esprit de vie à l'équipe. On le voit de lui. Puis quand c'est ce style de personne dans la chambre, puis il score pas, puis il commence à retirer, puis pas content, on le voit pas de tout de coup. Alors si sans la pression, il a des...
All right, the screen kind of went black for a second there, but we heard what Ken Hughes had to say.
It's a great soundbite.
Yeah. Yeah, he says, look, consistency is hard to find in the National Hockey League, especially when it comes to goal scoring. And he says, I know Ovechkin has done it for a very, very long time, but it's normal that you can have seasons of ups and downs. He says, my only worry would be if Cole would change the way he plays and feel the pressure and put more pressure on his shoulders, and it ends up changing his game. He's a very important player in our locker room as well. He has a real good spirit, brings a real good spirit to that room. I've seen Cole in the room, and that hasn't changed. He's still his jovial self, despite the fact that his goal production has gone down a little bit. So he says, I'm encouraged about that. Your thoughts on what he had to say?
I loved it. And I love the fact he was talking about a smile in the dressing room, how it's infectious and really important for the team. And I agree with that. So I'll use different players around the league, and it'll give your viewers and listeners an opportunity to do some comparable. You know, he talked about Ovechkin, a right-hand shot who gets the left side of the ice on the power play, the one-timer. So you look at Steven Stamkos down in Tampa, right-hand shot plays on the left side. You look at David Pastrnak in Boston, right-hand shot plays on the left-hand side of the ice. Cole Caulfield is the same. Now, he would be the smallest of that group. I mean, it's pretty apparent. He's not the biggest guy. But what he has, and it's very similar to Pastrnak, his release is so quick, and it's not going to overwhelm you with velocity. It's going to overwhelm you with quickness, with speed. And I think for Cole, as you get a better and more refined power play, especially once Lane Hudson gets there, it's going to change. You're going to see a different thing. And just like we talked about with Suzuki not being a point-of-game player, Cole can't manufacture his chances by himself, Tony. I think you know that. He needs a center iceman. And he's not the first winger, scoring winger, that couldn't manufacture chances by himself. Usually they need a centerman. They have one in Suzuki, but they need to have more so that all the pressure defensively isn't on that top threesome all the time with Slavkovsky and Suzuki and with Cole Caulfield.
So what does Kent Hughes see about Cole Caulfield in terms of, I know a year ago he was on pace. The pace was a 46-goal season, right. If he would have continued. This year you're looking at, you know, half of that production or just maybe a little bit more than that. He talked about the shooting percentage. Let's listen in.
Oh, it's a scorer. Il score peut-être moins cette année que qu'est-ce qu'il a fait l'année d'avant ou depuis que Martin est ici, mais plus que d'autres choses avec Cole, son shooting percentage, son efficacité, on dit, je pense qu'il est à 7%. Puis l'an passé, il était à 16%. L'autre jour, on a checké, puis je pense que parmi tous les joueurs qui ont 11 ou 12 buts, je pense qu'il est 110e en efficacité. Alors, c'est des choses qu'écoutent les coachs puis l'équipe du Allemand doit regarder avec lui. Est-ce que c'est la malchance? Est-ce qu'il y a de quoi dans son shot? Mais c'est sûr que l'efficacité a un certain aspect de son baisse de production au niveau des buts.
Pierre, I don't know how concerned Kent Hughes is with Cole Caulfield's goal production going down, but he took the time to dig into the stats or to ask some of his people, find some stuff here for me. I want to know about his shooting percentage. And he said, Cole's shooting percentage last year was 16%. This year, it's just over 7%. So he says, you take a look at all the other players in the National Hockey League that have scored 11 and 12 goals, because Cole had 11 goals when he checked his stat, which was a week ago. He says, you take a look at that, and he says, Cole is 110th in the National Hockey League in shooting percentage. So that's one thing that I noticed right away. So, okay, his goal production has gone down. His shooting percentage has gone down. Now, what's the next step to look into to try and connect the dots here or explain why one has led to the other?
One of the things I'd be looking at, and I love how thorough he was, that just shows me that they're not using a scatterbrain approach to this as a management team, and that's what you need to do. So hats off to Jeff Gordon and obviously to Kent and to the entire management group, because that's thorough thinking through a problem. I'd want to know how many shots he gets deflected or put out of play that are in high-scoring danger areas, number one. And then the other one I'd want to know is how many times is he missing the net from those high-scoring areas with shots, because we used to have a thing. It was way before analytics, Tony, with Mario Lemieux. We would tell Mario, if you get 5 shots on net, you're probably getting 3 points. Whether it's all goals or whether it's assists that lead to goals. But if you get 5 shots on goal per game, usually you're going to get 3 points in a game. And it kind of worked out if you really look at it over the course of his, 2 years that I was there and when he wasn't hurt. But I would just tell you that those are 2 things that he didn't mention that I would look at. How many times in high scoring areas is his shot deflected or put out of play? And how many times has he missed the net just on his own? So that's just 2 more things that would kind of cement everything in terms of where he's at in his development right now.
I would think, Pierre, there's a couple of other variables, and I think you alluded to it before. The injury situation has made it as such that everyone knows that Suzuki's going to Caulfield, right? Yeah. And he becomes pretty predictable to defend at that point, as good as he is. I mean, everyone knows on the power play, there's no one on the other side that has a one-timer like Cole Caulfield. So they're looking for Cole all the time. And another thing I would imagine is last night he scored a goal below the faceoff circle.
Yeah.
But, when he's getting shots outside the faceoff circle or above it, can it be coming off that shoulder injury, Pierre, that he lost just a little bit and it'll take a while for it to reinforce itself or to get back to his full strength, that if he was normally scoring above the faceoff circle last year, he might have to do it below this year before he gets back to full strength?
100%. I think there's a lot of merit to that. And you talk about that goal against Colorado. I would say that the Colorado goaltending coach is going to be all over the Colorado goalie from last night. He's stuck on the icing line protecting the short side of the net. He gives a far side of the net. That it's a great goal by Caulfield, but it's not an NHL goal for the goalie to give up. I can tell you that right now. And so, again, I would agree with what you just said. I think players that have that kind of injury that are relied on, it's kind of like a pitcher in baseball that has Tommy John surgery. Usually they don't have their heat for probably 6 to 8 months after surgery, maybe even longer. So it takes a little time for that to get rectified.
Pierre, can you recall any 3 goalie systems that have worked in the National Hockey League?
We had one in 91 and 92 in Pittsburgh, but we had a guy that was really good at it, Wendell Young. We had Frank Pietrangelo and Tommy Barrasso and Wendell Young. And then the next year we had Tommy Barrasso, Kenny Reagan, and Wendell Young. And the reason why it worked is Wendell was an amazing teammate, and he didn't complain. And he was really good because Tommy didn't want to practice a lot. So we had 2 goalies for practice. But it's not a perfect formula, and you got to have specific people that can make it work. But to say that it's common practice in the NHL, I would say no. And I would think you won't have it much longer. I got to think the Canadians are going to be ready to deal with one of their goalies pretty soon.
This is what Kent Hughes said regarding the 3 goalie system.
sûr, s'il y avait un échange qu'on pourrait faire, on le fera. Le plan n'était pas d'avoir trois gardiens pour la saison au complet. C'est encore pas le plan. Mais je peux pas vous dire à 100% aujourd'hui que c'est certain qu'on va faire un échange.
Kent Hughes, prior to that, prior to that, Kent Hughes was asked, whose call was this to have three goalies here? I mean, if there was ever any doubt, he said, well, it was my call. It's my call to have three goalies here. And then he added that, you know, he was convinced that Caden Primo was going to be picked up on waivers, and he didn't want that to happen.
So can I just say one thing, Tony?
Yeah, sure, of course you can.
If he went on waivers, he would have got picked up. I'm telling you right now, Primo would have been. He's right.
Pierre, you say that with a lot of certainty. Obviously, you have some information, and maybe obviously a part of that is that you believe in this young goaltender. Some stopped believing in him, and maybe they're starting to believe again after some real good performances this year where he stopped a lot of rubber. What's his ceiling?
I don't know that. I saw him play a lot at Northeastern University. I've seen him play in the American Hockey League a lot. I've obviously watched most of his games in the NHL. I don't know what his ceiling is yet. I don't know if he's going to be a significant good backup or is going to have a chance to be a starter. The one thing I can tell you is that if you look around the league right now, could a team like Colorado use a goalie? They could. Could a team like Carolina use a goalie? They could. Could a team like Los Angeles use another goalie because Phoenix Copley shredded his knee? Torn ACL, the answer is yes, they could. Look at the value, Tony, of what Casey DeSmith has provided Vancouver and Thatcher Demko. And people are saying, well, Thatcher Demko is this elite. He is. He's really elite. But he's even more elite because he's getting the proper rest. And when you're a Western Conference team and you don't get a lot of practice time and you spend a lot of time on airplanes, having a significant 1B is major. And that's why I look at a team like L.A. that thinks they're a legitimate cup contender or a team like Colorado who thinks they're a legitimate cup contender. Don't tell me that Caden Primo wouldn't have value in those situations because he would.
But how about Jake Allen? Because the signs point towards Allen being the guy that would be moved, unless I have a totally wrong read of this entire situation. Primo is the youngest of the three goalies. He makes the least money of the three goalies. The Canadians are still in a rebuild, so they can have time with Primo. He has not entered his prime. We still don't know what his ceiling is. And Jake Allen has a contract that is up at the end of next season. He's a veteran in the National Hockey League. He's already reached his ceiling. Going forward, it's going to be on the decline a little bit here. So it leads you to believe that Jake Allen is going to be the one that is going to be traded away.
Agreed.
I do some television work with Jean-Charles Lajoie on TVA Sport, who yesterday had a sit-down with Kent Hughes, and he asked him about Allen, and he said, to fix your three-goalie system, is it out of the question that you would send Jake Allen to the Laval Rocket? And he said, yes, it's out of the question that I'll send Jake Allen to the Laval Rocket. He's a great veteran who's very respected by his teammates. We're not doing that to him. Your thoughts on that?
Totally agree. Because you have to have credibility as an organization. And Kent's still new in terms of running a team. And you don't want to poison the pool that your players are swimming in. And if the players see a guy like Jake Allen get sent to the minors, they're saying, well, if they could do that to him, what are they going to do to me? And it ruins the morale of the organization. I totally support Kent on that. And I do think they'll be able to trade Jake Allen. People forget too, Tony, and you're really thorough, but you didn't say Jake Allen's been part of a Stanley Cup winning team. You know, it's those guys don't just fall off turnip trucks. They're hard to find. Jake is a phenomenal person. I've known him a long time since he played for the Montreal Juniors. And so I'm a big fan. I like him a lot. I think he will be the odd man out. I always felt that going into the season. And another thing that we haven't talked about yet, and I know the Canes are salivating, Tony, I don't know how much your listeners or viewers know about this player, but
Fowler,
Jacob Fowler is the real deal, Tony. So all these permutations about all these other goalies, whether it's Sam Bonthamboe, Caden Primo, Jake Allen, I will tell you right now that if Jacob Fowler continues on the path he's on, it's not going to be too long before he's going to be playing in the NHL. And he's got the mental makeup and the athleticism to be a starting goalie in the league would be really good. Really good.
Wow. I got it on that. Montembeau has blown me away. When the Canadiens and Marc Bergevin picked up Montembeau from the Florida Panthers, and I saw him play his first couple of games, I'm not no goalie expert by any means. As a matter of fact, you ask some people, I'm not an expert at all about anything. But anyway, I didn't think he was an NHL goalie, Pierre. This guy's an American Hockey League goalie. Yeah. And Montembeau has become, I think, a really good number one goaltender. For whatever reason, they don't want to... Marty St. Louis and Kent Hughes don't go out of their way to say he's a number one goalie. Can you tell me why that is, considering that he got a three-year contract extension in the last month? Why don't they say he's a number one goalie? Is it to keep him hungry all the time and or so that if they trade Allen, they're not letting other teams know that Allen is not a number one or not their number one?
I think it's to manage expectation in the city and with the fan base and with the player and with the team. It's a very difficult place to play goal. I think you know that. It's not easy. I remember spending countless hours talking to Jeff Hackett when Jeff was a goalie for the Montreal Canadiens. And he played in Chicago. He played with the New York Islanders. He played with the San Jose Sharks when they were an expansion team. And he told me straight up, best place I ever played, Montreal. Hardest place I ever played, Montreal. The expectation is so high. And it's kind of like being a starting quarterback in the NFL. You know, everybody loves the backup. Nobody loves a starter if they're not playing well. So you got to be really careful. I think that's veteran experience from Marty St. Louis. I really do. I really admire the way they've dealt with this goaltending situation. I think it's really been smart. But it's the first time I can think of in a very long time, Tony, that the Canadians have managed expectation on their goaltender, on their defenseman, and on all their players up front. I think they've done a really good job of that in a very difficult market.
Mathias Brunet brought up a real good point yesterday on BPM Sports Radio where he said, you go back and you think of Jocelyn Thibault. He arrived in Montreal in return for Patrick Waugh, who went to Colorado, and Patrick Waugh goes to Colorado, and that same year he wins the Stanley Cup. Imagine the pressure going forward. You're replacing Patrick Waugh, and he's winning a cup in Colorado, ended up winning two cups in Colorado. The one good thing about Montembeau, and thank God for him, is that unfortunately Carey Price's career is all but over, and he's no longer here. So Montembeau comes in. He's not replacing Price because Price is no longer here. And he's got Jake Allen and Caden Primo as part of the other, you know, goalies on the staff. And, you know, he doesn't have a big time goalie next to him, not yet anyway. So there's less pressure in that regard because you just talked about how suffocating the pressure could be already in Montreal to begin with. Thank God he doesn't have to go through something that Jocelyn Thibault had to go through.
I was there. That was really hard. I mean, I was first starting out, I was coaching in Ottawa. Then I got in the media side when Jocko was playing in Montreal. And I felt so bad for him, you know, because it wasn't just having himself be there. There was obviously a lot of pressure for Jose Theodore as well. People forget that. And so there was a lot of internal conflict. And it wasn't guys going after one another. It was just who's going to play tonight. And then Hackett came in, and it was different. It really was. It was different. I don't know if there's been too many people as nice as Jocelyn Thibault that have played in the league. What a nice man. Phenomenal person. But, yeah, it was tough for him right from the start. You know what's interesting? I remember I was coaching in Hartford, and we were playing in the Colisée in Quebec. And it was a big – I think we won the game 2-1 or 3-2. But the night before, they had all the top players eligible for the draft skating in between periods, and they did a shootout. And Alexander Daig was there. Christopher Pronger was there. Jason Ironhut. Niedermeyer was there. I don't know if Korea showed up or not, but they were all part of that draft. And Thibault was unbelievable in that game, in that shootout. It was amazing. I was watching it in between periods. I'm going, holy moly, this guy's really good. And you could see that the talent was there, but I think the mental pressure broke him at some point in Montreal. And it goes back to what I think the Canadiens are doing so wise, Tony. I really believe it. Managing expectation.
One or two more if we can, Pierre, and this has been a real treat. If you like it, share it with your friends, comment SICK, S-I-C-K, S-I-C-K, for all of you who are watching on YouTube, on Facebook, and on Twitter. And if you can leave us a five-star review on Apple, that's our way of feeling the love. We very much appreciate it. Subscribe to the SICK Podcast with Tony Marinaro, and subscribe to the SICK Podcast, The Eye Test, with Pierre Maguire and Jimmy Murphy. On Sean Monahan, who's was acquired from the Calgary Flames. The Canadiens got a first-round pick also in that deal. The plan was to trade him a year ago, right before the deadline. Unfortunately for Monahan, he got hurt 25 games in. He missed the rest of the season. He had 17 points in 25 games. They sat down at the end of the year. They said, listen, Sean, you're unrestricted free agent. You're probably looking for the four-year contract or the five-year contract. Because of the injury and the injuries in the past, you're not going to get it. You know what? Why don't we do this? Why don't we give each other one more chance together? You did well with us a year ago. You know the system. You know the coach. We feel you're going to do well here. And then we'll see if we can accommodate you come trade deadline. And if you happen, and you know what? Who knows? You might end up staying here. But they are in a rebuild. Everyone knows that. But he was asked about Sean Monahan as to what are you going to do with him? Are you going to trade him or are you going to keep him?
I think more generally, Harpin, was really like when you talk about signing a player to a one-year deal and convincing a player to come to a team on that like ours that's in a phase of building. You know, as a player, I think you evaluate it and look at what the opportunity is because you know you're coming in trying to reset. Right after a number of years of injury-riddled seasons where he hasn't been able to play, to be able to reset, but also to be able to play. So, the kind of more open-ended situation with Sean was come here, play. Let's see where we are at, when we get to the deadline.
Very diplomatic answer, Pierre. He's not going to come out and say, yeah, I'm going to trade the guy or I'm going to keep the guy with any certainty. You'd have to think, Pierre, for a team that's rebuilding, that you know, by the time the Canadiens are going to be really good and hopefully a cup contender, Sean Monahan probably won't be here at that time or he'll be way on the decline and wouldn't be able to help. Logic says they're going to move him. Who do you think would be a good fit or the best fit for Sean Monahan? And are you as well? Are you convinced that they're going to move him? Like I am?
I've been convinced for a while that they're going to move him, number one. Number two, I take no joy in saying that. I think Sean wants an opportunity. He's near the – even though he's 28, 29 years of age, he's had some tough injuries, and he's been in the league a while. I could see it now. I said this to Mitch Melnick on here the other day, our good friend. I said, hey, Mitch, when's the last time
– Never heard of him. I never heard of him.
When's the last time the Canadiens and the Bruins ever did a huge trade? And I don't think the highway's littered with a lot of big trades between the Bruins and the Canadiens. But I know there's an organizational need in Boston for a centerman like Sean Monahan because they don't have Krejci and they don't have Bergeron. And Charlie Coyle has had an amazing, amazing season. But again, it's just not that easy. So I could see a fit in Boston. I could see a fit with the New York Rangers. Filip Hedl is over in the Czech Republic training because of obviously injury issues. He's not back. They don't know what they're going to get from him. So I think there'd be a real good fit with the New York Rangers. I could see a fit with the Tampa Bay Lightning. I could see a potential fit out west with Colorado because they've had this revolving door of depth players coming in and out because of injury and because they're trying to make things work and they just haven't found a fit yet. I could see a potential fit with the Seattle Kraken if they started to make a significant move in a playoff situation. So I think there's more than enough places, Tony, for him to go. And I've thought about it a lot. And he's really re-energized his career with his time in Montreal. Because when he was in Calgary at the end, it wasn't looking good, Tony. It was not.
A couple more. Trevor Zegras. Mm-hmm. It, based on what we're hearing, he's on the block. He's out right now with an injury. But before he got injured, we were hearing that he was a player that could be had. He's got a ton of talent. He could be a human highlight reel. He could probably be the most exciting forward the Canadians have had since Kovalev. He could probably be as frustrating as Kovalev was when Kovalev wasn't on. He'll turn 23 in a couple of months. He has a history and chemistry with Cole Caufield. They were part of the U.S. National Development Program, the U-17 and U-18, and we know that they're very good friends. We also know that during this rebuild, there have been some empty seats every now and then, and people in Montreal love forwards who have a beautiful relationship with the puck. Trevor Zegras is one of those guys. Pierre, would you go after this player?
So I'm going to quantify everything I tell you by saying I probably know Trevor Zegras' game better than any scout in the National Hockey League because I watched him play for the Mid-Fairfield Rangers back when he was 12 and 13 and 14 years of age. My son was in the same program. It's an amazing program that developed Max Pacioretty, Jonathan Quick, tons and tons of players. Cam Atkinson is another one. Scott Morrow, who was just drafted by the Carolina Hurricanes in the second round. The Rangers, Fortescue, the pick of Fortescue in the second round this year. It's an amazing program. So I've known Trevor Zegras since that time. And his skill level is excessive. It's off the charts. And it's mind-boggling how creative he is offensively. There are times in the game, and you said it best, where he will unbelievably frustrate you. And there are other times in the game where he will lift you out of your seat and you're going to say, I can't believe how good this guy is. The relationship with Caufield is elite, and it's a well-said thing by you, Tony. I watched them both play significant games with the the National Team Development Program, both against college teams and against USHL teams. So, again, I know his body of work amazingly well. I would be interested in the player at the proper price point, but it's not something I would overpay for. No, I would not. But would I be interested in the player? The answer is absolutely yes, I would.
I know why he wouldn't be a player that you'd overpay for. I'm probably putting words in your mouth, but you can say he gives you flashes, but he never gives you that complete game. Is that it? That's my read of the player. Like, he can be asleep for an entire game, and then in one shift he can go out and he can score in Michigan. Yeah. And he can wow you, but he has a hard time putting it all together on a consistent basis. And he was on his production was on pace for about 30 points this year. How concerned are you about that?
Yeah, so I've been really spoiled in my career. When I came into the league, I worked with players like Mark Recchi and Kevin Stevens and Rick Tocchet and Brian Trocchi and Mario Lemieux and Ron Francis and Joe Mullen. There was never a question whether they were going to show up or not. They were there every day, night in and night out. It was so spoiled to be with those guys. And I remember we had a young player come in, Sean McEachran, who was an elite player at BU, played on a line with Keith Tkachuk and Tony Amonte. I mean, it was one of the best lines in the history of college hockey. We came into our team from the Olympics. And Mario said to me, if he doesn't start trying, we're going to have a problem. So I whispered it in Sean's ear. And sure enough, Sean was a huge part of our 92 Cup team. He played tremendously well. And I think he learned a lot from that. I don't think Trevor's ever had to deal with that. You know, I had the privilege, and it was, to coach Pat Verbeek. He played on a line with Jeff Sanderson and Andrew Castles for me in Hartford. Pat is about as intense as anybody I know. And I just don't know if there's a fit with Pat and Zegras in Anaheim just because of the way Pat played the game. He never took a shift off. He never took a practice off. The guy would play with, you know, broken body parts. He was one of the most intense guys I've ever met in the National Hockey League. So Trevor's just different. Trevor's different. And if you can deal with that, his skill level's off the charts, and maybe one day it kicks in.
So when you said you wouldn't overpay, and I'm not going to ask you what you would give up because I wouldn't want, you know, maybe, you know, player two could be disrespected. But if you would have to say prospect, second liner, winger, number three defenseman, what do you think
I think the Canadiens have done a really good job with their defense. And I don't think there's an organizational need in Anaheim for defense. If you look at how they're structured right now in Anaheim with their prospects in San Diego, and also with the guys they've drafted, and also with, I'll give you an example. They thought they were deep enough on defense, they traded Henry Thrun to San Jose. Henry Thrun is playing as a top two defenseman for San Jose right now. He could be in Anaheim. They traded him away because they have so much depth in Anaheim. So I don't think they'd be looking for defense. I think they'd be looking for probably a centerman. And it would be interesting to see if the Canes would be prepared to do that.
Fantastic stuff, Pierre. Slafkovský last night was in, well, I'll end it with this, real good company. Yeah. Nathan MacKinnon, Slafkovský, Cale Makar. Those were the three players that had more shots than anybody else. MacKinnon was number one with seven. Slafkovský had six. Makar had six as well. Slafkovský went up against Mikko Rantanen. When Slafkovský was drafted in National Hockey League, they asked him, "You're comparable." And he said, "I think I can be Mikko Rantanen." That's a pretty good player, Pierre.
Yeah, real good player.
You talked to us about how much you saw Slafkovský when he was in Finland. Who's the comparable? Is it Rantanen?
I'd say Rantanen. Yeah, I would. It's funny you bring that up because, you know, I watched Rantanen a lot before he came over. And, you know, when I watched Slafkovský, I wish he'd have been put in more dynamic situations. He just wasn't, whereas Rantanen was when you saw him. I remember, too, and the guy had an amazing career, Olli Jokinen. He didn't win a lot, but if you look at Olli Jokinen's numbers, it's just, you know, he played a lot of games in the league and he did some really good things, especially near the end of his career. So I thought there was a combo there between, and I'm just talking about Finnish players, obviously, because Slafkovský played in Finland and Turku, the same town where Saku Koivu was from. So I saw like a hybrid between Olli Jokinen and obviously Mikko Rantanen. I thought that would be a pretty darn good player.
Hey, Pierre, I know I told you it was the last one, but
I can talk to you.
No. I have to get your opinion on this. Did you see what Joel Bouchard did the other night for the Syracuse Crunch?
I did not. I know he's coaching there. I did not.
Okay. His Syracuse Crunch the other night took on, when the Bruins played the Devils, the Utica Comets.
Yeah. Kevin Dineen's a coach of Utica. He's a tough guy.
2-1, 2-1 for Syracuse. Midway through the first period, Syracuse are on the power play. It's a 5-on-3. Uh-huh. He pulls the goalie. Utica scores on a backhand 150 feet away to tie the game at 2.
Yeah.
Syracuse go on to win the game. They win 5-4. Joel Bouchard's asked about it at the end of the game. He says, "I'm just trying stuff. I thought it was a great opportunity to try it. I liked the way my team started. I felt that even if we would have got scored on, we were playing really, really well. My good players were rested. It was a clean sheet of ice. It was good ice. I tried it." I'd love to know what you feel about that.
I think it's creative. I think it's courageous. But I also know that because of the injury situation in New Jersey right now, they're decimated by injury. Utica, I believe, is in last place going into last weekend in their division in the American Hockey League. So I think Joel knew he probably had a little bit more horsepower than Kevin did. I'm not sure he'd be doing that in an NHL game or if he thought the lineups were pretty balanced. I don't think he'd be doing that if he's playing against Belleville. Belleville's got a good team. David Bell's in Belleville, and they got a good team. I don't think he'd be doing that against Belleville.
You imagine doing that in the third period, then you end up losing the game. That's unbelievable.
I don't think so.
Pierre, I tell you the same thing every time I talk to you. What a pleasure, what a privilege, what an honor. Thank you so much for all your time tonight. I know that everyone watching, everyone listening, really appreciate it because tonight was like Christmas. It was amazing.
I just really enjoyed doing this with you, Tony. I love talking hockey. I couldn't be more proud of you and what you've done with your career. So thank you for having me. It means a lot.
Thank you. I don't know if you saw this, but Momesos is closing on the 27th. You see that?
And you know what? I did know that. And my mother also told me that. You know, she still lives in Montreal. So I'm aware, which is tough, you know?
Yeah, it really is. Thank you, Pierre. We'll talk to you soon.
You got it, Tony. Anytime.
There you have it. Pierre Maguire. Wow. once again, I want to thank all the sponsors. I want to thank Energy Transportation Group. I want to thank Accent Insurance Solutions. And, of course, I want to thank Playground. And also, of course, La Bitta TV. Speaking of Accent Insurance Solutions, you know insurance isn't created equal, and you know where to find the right solution for you. Accent Insurance, they don't sell insurance. They shop insurance for you to find the right product right on the money, whatever your insurance needs, home, auto, or business. It's funny, when I saw Accent's phone number, I thought of my buddy Sergio Momesso. Speaking of Momesso's, at 514-363-3636. That's the number to call. Thank you, everyone, for watching. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same place, right after the Canadiens hockey game, and bring you the Sick Podcast at 10 p.m. Have a good one. Ciao for now.
And that's a wrap. Hope you don't miss us too much until next time. Follow the Sick Podcast with Tony Marinaro on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. The Sick Podcast is brought to you by Energy Transportation Group. Driven to be different. La Vida TV. Embrace your true nature. And Playground, your premier gaming destination.